Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the frozen tundra, or at working on your favorite project at work, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. I'm glad that you've tuned in to get squared tonight. We're coming to you live this February 26, 2012, from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. The solar wind today is 447 kilometers per second, and the proton count is the highest I have ever seen at 16.3 protons per cubic centimeter. I am not believing it. I'm not going outside. There are several sunspot clusters on the sun which currently hold no threat for solar flares. So why the high proton count then, 16.3 protons? Well, they must be arriving from somewhere other than the sun. Venus, Jupiter, and the crescent moon are beaming through the evening twilight, forming a bright triangle visible through the City of Lights, or even thin clouds, even on the west coast. A coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetic field today. The impact was weak and does not appear set to cause a strong geomagnetic storm. All right. Tonight on X Squared Radio, we have a guest coming on in about half an hour. We have the indomitable Mona McCrae. Mona McCrae has quite the bio, let me tell you. Known her for many years. She is very accomplished. She's an award-winning paralegal who worked for one of the premier law firms in the world, Fenwick & West, in the San Francisco Bay Area. She graduated top in her class in the Paralegal College of America in 1995, Santa Clara Bar Association. It goes on and on. She's a trained radiologist who has worked in the medical field assessing information trends in diagnosis and how that information relates to the worldwide illness that we all seem to be living with at the moment. She had a near-death experience in December of 2009, and that changed everything. She's into druidry, which we will discuss tonight. She's an author. She's a songwriter. She's a musician. She's a videographer. Quite the bio. She's coming on in half an hour. You don't want to miss it. I promise it will be mind-expanding, and we're going to talk about the present, the future, the past, all in one. Do some time travel together. I think you'll enjoy it. Speaking of time travel, fruit and seeds hidden in an ice age squirrel's burrow in Siberian permafrost have been resurrected into a flower by Russian scientists. Wow. Could you say Jurassic Park? Using a pioneering experiment, the Silene stenophylla has become the oldest plant ever to be regrown, and it is fertile, producing white flowers and viable seeds. The seeds date back 30,000 to 32,000 years and raise hopes that iconic Ice Age mammals like the woolly mammoth could eventually be resurrected. The researchers, who published their findings in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in the U.S., said the results prove that permafrost serves as a natural depository for ancient life forms, whether they came from this planet or not. We consider it essential to continue permafrost studies in search of an ancient genetic pool, that of pre-existing life, which hypothetically has long since vanished from the Earth's surface, the scientists said in the article. I guess my question would be, a mere 32,000 years ago, are you sure? And it was in a squirrel's burrow? Do you think a squirrel ran all the way up there in the Siberian desert and buried it in the snow? Or do you think that maybe they had the right kind of climb that these flowers could grow a mere 32,000 years ago? Doesn't that kind of throw into question the archaeologists' claim that the Siberian desert has been permafrost for a couple hundred thousand years? Very interesting stuff. Canadian researchers had earlier regenerated some significantly younger plants from seeds found in burrows. Svetlana Yashina of the Institute of Cell Biophysics of the Russian Academy of Sciences, who led the regeneration effort, said the revived plant looked very similar to its modern version, which still grows in the same area in northeastern Siberia. The Russian research team recovered the fruit after investigating dozens of fossil burrows hidden in ice deposits on the right bank of the lower Kolyma River in northern Siberia. Northern Siberia sounds really cold. They were firmly cemented together and often totally filled with ice, making any water infiltration impossible, creating a natural freezing chamber fully isolated from the surface. The burrows were located 125 feet below the present surface in layers containing bones of large mammals, such as mammoth, woolly rhinoceros. Now that would be cool to see. Bison, horse, and deer. The squirrels dug the frozen ground to build their burrows, which are about the size of a soccer ball, putting in hay first and then animal fur for a perfect storage chamber, said Stanislav Gubin, one of the authors of the study who spent years rummaging through the area for squirrel burrows. It's a natural cryobank. If we're lucky, we can find some frozen squirrel tissue, said Mr. Gubin, and this path could lead us all the way to the mammoth. Dun, dun, dun. Wow, that's so cool. All right. We like to bust myths on this program, and one of the myths that people have laid on me and laid on you your entire life is that you must have at least 8 hours sleep a day, or you're going to get all stressed out, fat, and die early. Not true. The myth of the 8 hour sleep. I love this. I love this. Stephanie Hegarty of the BBC World Service came up with this. And I like it. I like it. We often worry about lying awake in the middle of the night, but could it be good for you? A growing body of evidence from both science and history suggests that the 8 hour sleep may be unnatural. 8 hour sleep may be unnatural. In the early 1990s, psychiatrist Thomas Ware conducted an experiment in which a group of people were plunged into darkness for 14 hours every day for a month. I hate to tell you this, but my youngest daughter would love that. Yeah, she could sleep 14 hours a day, no problem. All right, it took some time for their sleep to regulate, but by the fourth week, the subjects had settled into a very distinct sleeping pattern. They slept first for 4 hours, then woke for 1 or 2 hours before falling into a second 4 hour sleep. Though sleep scientists were impressed by the study, among the general public, the idea that we must sleep for 8 consecutive hours persists. In 2001, historian Roger Eckert of Virginia Tech, one of my favorite schools, not for their football team, but for their surface analysis lab. Very world class. Also a great adhesives program. Anyway, let me get back to it. I got distracted. In 2001, historian Roger Eckert of Virginia Tech published a seminal paper drawn from 16 years of research, revealing a wealth of historical evidence that humans used to sleep in two distinct chunks. Sorry. I was thinking of something like, okay, I got up and raided the fridge, and I ate half the pizza cold, and I got sleepy again and went back to sleep. Everybody does that. No, okay, I'm going to get back to the study, though, because this is a seminal paper, okay, revealing a wealth of historical evidence that humans used to sleep in two distinct chunks. His book, At Day's Close, Night in Times Past, published 4 years later, unearths more than 500 references to a segmented sleep pattern in diaries, court records, medical books, and literature, from Homer's Odyssey to an anthropological account of modern tribes in Nigeria. It's true. It's true. Sanridam is evidence of activity at night, much like the experience of Ware's subjects. These references describe a first sleep, which began about 2 hours after dusk, followed by a waking period of 1 or 2 hours, and then a second sleep. It's not just the number of references. It's the way they refer to it, as if it was common knowledge, Eckert says. During this waking period, people were quite active. They often got up, they went to the toilet or smoked tobacco, and some even visited neighbors. Most people stayed in bed, read, wrote, and often prayed. Countless prayer manuals from the late 15th century offered special prayers for the hours in between sleeps. And these hours weren't entirely solitary. People often chatted to bedfellows or had sex. A doctor's manual from 16th century France even advised couples that the best time to conceive was not at the end of a long day's labor, but after the first sleep. You know, let's take a nap first. When they have more enjoyment and do it better. Eckert found that references to the first and second sleep started to disappear during the late 17th century. This started among the urban upper classes in Northern Europe and over the course of the next 200 years filtered down to the rest of Western society. I wonder why. By the 1920s, the idea of a first and second sleep had receded entirely from our social consciousness. Well, until about 5 years ago. When segmented sleep was the norm, Charles Dickens and Barnaby Rudge noted, I'm sorry, Charles Dickens with his book Barnaby Rudge in 1840, he says, he knew this even in the horror with which he started from his first sleep and threw up the window to dispel it by the presence of some object beyond the room, which had not been, as it were, the witness of his dream. And Miguel Cervantes in Don Quixote, 1615. Don Quixote followed nature, and being satisfied with his first sleep, did not solicit more. As for Sancho, he never wanted a second, for the first lasted him from night to morning. Interesting stuff. Got more. Old Robin of Portingall. And of the wakening of your first sleep, you shall have a hot drink made, and at the wakening of your next sleep, your sorrows will have a shake. Interesting stuff. The Tiv tribe in Nigeria employed the terms first sleep and second sleep to refer to specific periods of the night. He attributes the initial shift to improvements in street lighting. Ding, 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 ding. That's the correct answer. Domestic lighting and a surge in coffee houses, which were sometimes open all night, like Amelie's in Charlotte. If you ever get to Charlotte, North Carolina, you have to go to Amelie's. Amelie's French Bakery, open 24 hours a day, over 10,000 square feet. You cannot leave North Carolina without going, okay? Everybody knows this. As the night became a place for legitimate activity, and as that activity increased, the length of time people would dedicate to rest dwindled. In his new book, Evening's Empire, historian Craig Kozlovsky put forward an account of how this happened. Associations with night before the 17th century were not good, he said. The night was a place populated by people of disrepute, criminals, prostitutes, politicians, I'm sorry, I added that, and drunks. Okay, politicians need to be in there. Even the wealthy who could afford candlelight had better things to spend their money on. There was no prestige or social value associated with staying up all night. That changed in the wake of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. Protestants and Catholics became accustomed to holding secret services at night during periods of persecution. If earlier the night had prolonged to reprobates, now respectable people became accustomed to exploiting the hours of darkness. Just like us, we do it. We work till 2 o'clock in the morning because we get more done while you're sleeping than most people do all day. This trend migrated to the social sphere too, but only for those who could afford to live by candlelight. With the advent of street lighting, however, socializing at night began to filter down through the classes. In 1667, I know this is going to blow your mind. In 1667, Paris became the first city in the world to light its streets using wax candles in glass lamps. It was followed by Lille in the same year and Amsterdam 2 years later, where a much more efficient oil-powered lamp was developed. London didn't join their ranks until 1684, just a mere 17 years later. But by the end of the century, that would be 1700, more than 50 of Europe's major towns and cities were lit at night. Night became fashionable, and spending hours lying in bed was considered a waste of time. How about that? You know, a small city like Leipzig in central Germany employed 100 men to tend 700 lamps. That's like 7 lamps per man. Unless you're following the old 80-20 rule, where 20% of the people do 80% of the work. Yeah, in which case, it's 140 lamps per man. So that sounds right. People were becoming increasingly time conscious and sensitive to efficiency, certainly before the 19th century, says Roger Eckerch. But the Industrial Revolution intensified that attitude by leaps and bounds. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 1829, patents came out, and if no disease or accidents there intervene, they will need no further repose than that obtained in their first sleep, which custom will have caused to terminate by itself, just at the usual hour. And then, if they turn upon their ear to take a second nap, they will be taught to look upon it as an intemperance, not at all redounding to their credit. I would say most people are redounded. Today, most people seem to have adopted quite well to the 8-hour sleep, but Eckerch believes that many sleeping problems may have roots in the human body's natural preference for segmented sleep, as well as the ubiquity of artificial light. This could be the root of a condition called sleep maintenance insomnia, where people wake during the night and have trouble getting back to sleep. The condition first appears in literature at the end of the 19th century, at the same time as accounts of segmented sleep disappear. For most of evolution, we slept a certain way. Waking up during the night is part of normal human physiology. So if you want to get up, you want to meditate, you want to watch a late movie, you want to watch the rerun of the news, which I don't recommend. I also don't recommend eating heavily. You can get yourself a glass of milk, a couple slices of raisin toast with warm butter, something light, and then you can go back to sleep. Or if you have a friend along, you can do something else. So that's just a little trip to the past. So you can understand that your life is not all upside down. You are not so Edisonized that you have to worry about getting up in the middle of the night. Usually it's around 2 a.m. for most people, 2 to 3 a.m. Great time to think. Great time to sit down at the computer and compose. Lots of cool stuff. Listen to archives of X Squared Radio. You know, the good stuff. Also in the news, by the way, don't forget, in 15 minutes, Mona McRae, the indomitable Mona McRae, Mona Barona, is coming on X Squared Radio. We're going to talk for a couple of hours. Just her and me, and you can come along. I want to let you know that our phone lines are open all night. We do not discriminate. We have a very open-minded call screener. He only asks you two questions. What's your name? And what do you want to talk about? The number toll-free in the United States or North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, where we say yes. And anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us. It's 530-413-6472. Now, before you get all crazy, when the mail runs tomorrow and you get your tax refund check, or in some cases your earned income credit, because, you know, 47% of the nation lives below the poverty level or something like that, 47% of college graduates with advanced degrees. I can't remember now what the statistic is. But when that check comes in, don't just run out and spend it. Come on. Invest in your future. Invest in something really cool. Invest in something you can talk about for the rest of your life. Join me at the Maya 2012 conference in Chichen Itza. How cool would that be? Come on. We go down there at Ground Zero where Pakal pulled it all together. The Mayan calendar made its you know, national debut and was dug up later in 1958 and really, you know, turned into the 2012 event that we are now celebrating in advance. You come with me, Greg Braden, Maureen St. Germain, more than a dozen other world-class speakers, December 13th through December 22nd. I promise to have you home by Christmas. And boy, will you have some stories to tell. Not only will you get to hear the speakers, you'll get to be at Ground Zero of the entire 2012 saga. And rumor has it that Sting and Carlos Santana will be playing somewhere in the same venue. I don't have that for sure solid, but the organizers have told me that the word is out. I don't know what kind of marketing they're going to do. It's probably going to be a sellout, but you don't have to worry because we're going to be in the area and all the hotel rooms are ours. Join me, Maya 2012. All you have to do is click on the orange banner on the right-hand side at xsquaredradio.com. And get your deposit in. Don't squander that tax check. In the case that you don't have or want a passport, you don't want to leave the country, you don't want to go down to Mexico, no problem. No problem. You can come and join me in the Midwest at the Pythagoras Conference in October. You just click on the blue Pythagoras Conference banner on the right-hand side at xsquaredradio.com, you'll get $100 off, and you don't have to fly anywhere because we're going to be at a casino resort in southern Indiana. It's within an eight-hour drive of 73% of the country. 50 world-class speakers from all over the world coming to this conference for you. You don't have to fly. All the arrangements that can be made for you. And it's in the Midwest. Now, that's just never happened. We don't have conferences like this in the Midwest. You have to go to California. You have to go to Oregon. You have to go to Washington State. You got to fly. No, you don't. You can come to the Midwest, southern Indiana, the Pythagoras Conference. Don't lose out this year. Come on. Now, some strange stuff going on in the sky. A couple of stories on this a couple of years ago, but I haven't seen anything this definitive. What would you say if I told you that Earth's clouds are getting lower? I mean lower to the ground. It's true. NASA's satellite has discovered it. Earth's clouds got a little lower, about 1% on average during the first decade of this century. It's kind of alarming, but it may actually be an automatic temperature regulator. Scientists at the University of Auckland in New Zealand analyzed the first 10 years of global cloud top height measurement from March 2000 to February 2010. From the multi-angle imaging spectroradiometer, that's called the MISR for short. NASA always has acronyms. The multi-angle imaging spectroradiometer instrument on NASA's Terra spacecraft. The study published recently in the journal Geophysical Research Letters revealed an overall trend of decreasing cloud height. Global average cloud height declined by around 1% over the decade, or by around 100 to 130 feet. Most of the reduction was due to fewer clouds occurring at very high altitudes. Lead researcher Roger Davies said that while the record is too short to be definitive, it provides a hint that something quite important might be going on. Wouldn't you like to know? Longer-term monitoring will be required to determine the significance of the observation for global temperatures. Of course it will. A consistent reduction in the cloud height would allow Earth to cool to space more efficiently, reducing the surface temperature of the planet and potentially slowing the effects of global warming. This, my friends, is a climate change. This may represent a negative feedback mechanism built into the planet. We don't know exactly what causes the cloud heights to lower, but it must be due to a change in the circulation patterns that give rise to cloud formation at high altitude. What would change the circulation pattern? Could it be a shifting polar alignment? Interesting. Wouldn't it be neat to correlate the two pieces of data? This instrument uses 9 cameras at different angles to produce a stereo image of clouds around the globe, allowing measurement of their altitude and movement. Well, if you linked this with the pole shift that it seems to be ever rapidly coming on, last few years, the measurement was something like 25 miles a year, and now we're up to 40 miles a year that the North Magnetic Pole is moving in a straight line towards Siberia. That's alarming, folks. That is, if that continues, we get to 100 and then 200 and then 500 miles a year. Remember, it's only about 11,500 miles or so. And you're at the halfway point. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to do the math. It doesn't take 100,000 years for a pole shift to occur on this planet. It could probably occur in a matter of weeks, perhaps even days. Now, what would be the severity of that? That's a good question. Maybe the clouds would be lower. Hold on a second. Cranberry ginger ale. You got to have some. So maybe it would change the patterns of the jet stream and the way birds migrate and the way fish school and the way insects pollinate plants. It could have wide-reaching effects on the planet. It could be part of the regulation system. Not regulatory. We get too many regulations, don't we? The regulation system of the Earth that allows temperature to balance itself out. All right, it is 8:25. In 5 minutes, Mona McRae is going to come on. You know that a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. This book was a culmination of a series of events that caused me to awaken, caused me to wake up out of my more than 50-year sleep. I won't say that. I wasn't a sleeper. I was awake for some of my life as a youth, and then somewhere along the way, I went to sleep, just like you. And then you tuned into this radio program and said, hey, somebody's out there saying the stuff that I like to hear. I remember this stuff. And I did too. And I woke up. And I have been the original person ever since. Well, another person was at this location, the indomitable Mona McRae. Mona McRae is a musician, producer, vocalist, songwriter, author, photographer, videographer, actor, artist, poet, and druid and wonderful person. She is an award-winning paralegal. She's a trained radiologist. And then she had a near-death experience in December of 2009. A little bit different than a lot of people. No, she wasn't hit by lightning twice. No, she didn't drown. No, she didn't have a brain tumor. She is allergic to speeding cars, just like me. Mona is an ovate in the order of bards, ovates and druids. Member since 1994 and studies current druid philosophical activities and druids in history. We could talk about that tonight. She spent time exploring the forests of Washington State with the Order's chosen chief, Philip Carr Gome, over Samhain, 1997. And she's also an author. She's written two books related to quantum activism, like my colleague, Amit Goswami, including working with the energy of various semi-precious stones and gems in healing. My friend Scott down in Florida would be very interested in hearing this. And manifesting reality all comes down to focus. Everything comes down to focus when talking about quantum creativity. This is one of the main themes in the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. The book only shows you the mathematical reason behind focusing and what to focus on. Some stunning discoveries that came through meditation and, of course, experimentation and the scientific method. So as that evidence was gathered, the lecture, the education of how resonance can be applied to chaos with intention, and you can coax creativity out of the maelstrom quantum foam of this universe. Mona is also a musician. Over a lifetime of performance, she has appeared and or performed with such greats as the legendary John Lee Hooker, Grammy winner, Arkansas, Larry Davis, Dr. John, Elvin Bishop, Buddy Miles, Jimi Hendrix, Tim Bogert, Vanilla Fudge, Beck Bogert, and Appice, to name only a few. Mona started playing music at age 2.5 years when her folks bought her a small piano for Christmas, and she sat down and started playing songs, including Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, though she had never played music before. Dun, dun, dun. She is the resurrected Beethoven. I'm kidding. I threw that in there. It's not in her bio. Mona is a member of the E-SETI family. That stands for James Gilliland's Ranch. E-SETI family and filmed several of James Gilliland's World Transformation Conferences, at which moi spoke, and Mona was the videographer that captured my voice on film. She's a phenomenal photographer. Just happens to be in the right place at the right light with the right thing, and she has a knack for picking up unusual phenomena in photography, including the now famous Mary photo of the veil of light that James uses on the cover of his book, Becoming Gods. And I've seen the photo, and I've seen the movie, and if you haven't seen the movie, you should. Becoming Gods, Becoming Gods 2, and Contact Has Begun. Wow. Great book, great books, and a great movie. Awesome. Mona's also an actress, worked in the late Brittany Murphy's last film, Something Wicked, 2010, in Eugene, Oregon. Mona can currently be seen in the several independent movies. Find out about Mona Lee, acting at the Internet Movie Database. And she's also a producer. This is only a three-hour program, Mona, but I'm gonna get my way through this.
I'm still laughing, Brooks, about the allergic to speeding cars.
That's right.
You caught me with that one.
You had an adverse reaction when she had a dose of speeding car and had a near-death experience.
Yeah, but can you imagine what that did to my thinking? Being one of those quantum wishers who likes to think that we create our own reality. All of a sudden, I was forced to make a decision. Do I still believe that? Because I woke up dead in the street, you know. So as time went on and I began to, you know, get more and more back in my body, I would talk to my friends that are real involved in quantum physics and creating your own reality. And I'd say, look, I know that we all agreed that, you know, we create our own realities, but I did not create this. And they, of course, would laugh and say, yes, you did.
Well, so, the idea is that you created a Dodge, not a car. You were supposed to dodge.
I didn't see the car coming. I was lucky. I was lucky because I don't have to relive that memory. But the light show was pretty spectacular. That was great. I'm walking across the street. It's a highway. And I'm halfway across. So I stopped looking to my left, which was north, and I started looking to my right because that's the only direction someone should have been coming from at that point. So I didn't see it coming, but what I did see is horizon to horizon, a kaleidoscope show of colors in white, gold, and silver. It was just amazing, and I remember going, wow, what's this? And that was it. I was gone. I had no time to realize that I was going to be scooped up onto the hood of a car, rammed into the windshield, and then, bless her heart, the poor woman who hit me slammed on her brakes and launched me across the highway, good 50 feet. And the reason that I know I was out of my body and dead is because getting back into my body was extremely painful. Not the pains of being broken head to toe, which I was, but painful in that out of my body I felt lighter than air. It was a freedom. It was incredible. Wow. But I decided that I didn't want to stay where I was. I wanted to go back to what I had going on here. And so into my body I went, and I could have been made out of Mississippi mud at that point. It felt like I went from weighing absolutely nothing to weigh in about 3,000 pounds. And that was before I regained consciousness, but I can remember that. And then, of course, when I regained consciousness, I had all the other fun thrills to go with the broken bones and shattered this and that, you know, that I had. And but, yes, it did. It made me question everything, as it often does.
Well, I know. I know what you mean. We all... And we don't necessarily get hit by cars, but we all kind of have our collisions in life, and some of them are quite traumatic, and some of them are just a series of unfortunate events. And somewhere along the way, we turn our eyes skyward, and we say, hey, why me? What's going on here? What did I do? What do I got to learn here? What didn't I learn here?
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be the mystery that most people are tuning in tonight to hear about, because... You know, we get deluged with all kinds of different philosophers that come out and say, you know, come to my workshop and learn how to overcome this life trauma, or, you know, take my herbs or rub my oil on your forehead or whatever.
Right.
I mean, we've been hearing that since the 1800s, since the printed word in the late 1500s. But there is a common thread in the real genuine ones, like you and like James and others that I've personally met, in that when the spirit separates from the body briefly and then returns to the body, you bring with it a memory, and you can recall the memory. And that's
right.
That's what I want to talk about tonight, because I think what happened when we were born, the same thing happened. We were this ethereal, eternal intelligence, this wonderful, leaping, flying, multidimensional being. Then we got slammed into this biological transducer that can't talk, it can't walk, it can't even wipe its own butt. And it takes about 8 or 9 years before you even step up to your own eyes.
Right.
We're in the background while this hellion runs up and down the hall and spits out its food and argues with its brother or sister. And then you become self-aware. But by then, it's too late. We can't remember the rejoining moment.
Right.
You got a second chance at the rejoining moment.
I actually remembered my rejoining moment. That's my first memory. And I was in my high chair, and I was probably pre-verbal. But I remember this. I'm bringing this up because I love your story about what you remembered when you woke up and the two suns, another galaxy, in a galaxy far, far away, and the things that you shared at James's conference about remembering. Because when I was in the high chair, I saw my mother and my stepfather arguing. And it wasn't the arguing so much that confused me. It was the fact that they were using their mouths and their vocal cords to communicate, and I couldn't understand why, because where I came from, we didn't speak. We just thought. So that's when I knew I was in the wrong place. I was going, uh-oh. I'm not sure this is where I was supposed to be sent here, you know. But yeah, I was shocked. Why are these people going to all this trouble to communicate? All I have to do is think that, you know, that's what seemed natural to me. And so I, you know, never did really quite feel like I was in the right place on this planet. I think a lot of people have had that feeling from time to time.
That one of the things I discovered, and it's not just from reading, just from all of the people that I've had an opportunity to meet in the last 6 years, mm-hmm. that there are two classes of beings on this planet. There are those that have been incarnated over and over again on this planet for thousands of years.
All right.
Then, because of low infant mortality rates, specialization in food and water control and refrigeration, we have a lot more biological transducers on this planet, and so there were not enough souls to occupy all the bodies that were being born on this planet, and there were other planets that had been wiped out, like my old planet, and they were privileged to come here. But like you, when we're born into this biological transducer and we realize, what? I only have 5 sentences to interpret the universe?
That's right.
And
I have to stay in which dimensions? Excuse me? You know, I happen to be real fond of anything over 7. 7 to 13 is good. 3, not my favorite. You know, it's just too limiting.
Skills in the other, and that's the problem is, like you said, we're uncomfortable. We're out of step. We are trying to rely on these telepathic skills, both in sending and receiving from ourselves to others and from others, and we're not getting a clear picture back. We're getting all this spiral energy. I hear the words coming out of your mouth, but that's not what you're thinking.
Right. I mean, exactly.
Time.
Exactly. A good observation is one that you made at James's, where you were talking about a group of people witnessing a car accident. And they all give a different story. And I know I listened in just a little bit last night to one of your interviews, and you were talking about a similar thing where realities come together, that we have at this point 7 billion realities that we're all creating together in the same time-space continuum. So where does my reality stop and yours begin? And then there's the mass mind consciousness all creating this manifest destiny or whatever you want to call it, the reality. When do you even know when you're creating and when you're not and with whom? For instance, my accident, could easily be seen as a collision of realities. What I was creating and seeing in my world that day at that particular time, this other person was seeing and experiencing something else, and we got in the way of each other, you know?
Well, the interesting thing is that neither one of you, A, expected this to happen.
Right.
B, neither one of this, prior to it happening, neither one of you observed it into happening.
No.
So in a sense, it was a completely unobserved creation.
Right.
So the point is, the point I'm trying to make is, if it wasn't observed, from a scientific point of view, it couldn't have existed. But it proves that it was observed before you ever got there. It was observed into reality as an agreement between the two of you, not only...
Oh, right, yeah, the reincarnation agreement.
Right.
That we all make, you know.
Right.
I really felt just terrible for the woman who hit me, because she was quite certain that I was dead, because I certainly appeared to be. The lump in the street that had been my body a few seconds before didn't look like it could still be alive. It's rather awkward positioning, right? Anyone who was still alive would surely be trying to get out of this particular stance, you know, face down in the street with things pointing in the wrong directions. And so, you know, she got out of the car and came over and looked at me, saw me basically dead, and kind of lost her mind on the spot. And it seriously affected her, and it has, of course, ever since, because what she experienced between the time that she first looked at me and thought that she had killed me and the time that she found out that I wasn't actually dead, came back in, not ready to go, her trauma was already irreversible. You know, that's what she saw coming. That's what happened to her, you know, and that's just a terrible, terrible place to be. I thought, you know, at least I can heal physically. And I didn't see it coming. But what she saw and experienced is in some ways far worse than what I did. Because I'm back to living most of my life the way I did before I got hit. She's not.
That's what I want to talk about at this moment, is before this event happened, you were already accomplished. You were already, you know, well on your path of exploration.
Yeah, I was. I had a plan.
How did things change for you besides the rehabilitation? How did things change for you spiritually after the event?
Two really important things happened for me. As you know, I knew my biological father as a small child, but I forgot about him. I turned my back on him when he didn't come and find me when I was of age. I thought, well, you don't want to know me? I don't want to know you, whoever you were, because I barely remembered. But in, you know, little girls and daddies, you know, my daddy didn't want me. That's one of the things that I had lumped up carrying around. And I didn't find my biological father's family until about 2005. And, of course, by then my father had already passed away. But I did get to meet, you know, two brothers, and that was really wonderful. But it still didn't make any of that feel better. The daddy, well, yeah, now I know who he was, but he still didn't want me. right, in my little girl's mind. And while I had to get regressed to find this out, because things in my near-death experience were not as crystal clear as like what James had in his. He remembers having conversations and what he saw and what he brought back. Everything that I was sensing was darker. I was not able to sense as much. And so I had a favorite psychic friend of mine named Debbie Smith regress me at one point, because I trusted her. And I said, I really need to go back there and find out what happened. Because I knew things had occurred. I just couldn't get it all in one cup, you know.
Yeah, that's good. And that's so what I mentioned in the car accident in my presentation, that you got to get external to it. Look at the surveillance film, as it were. What really happened on that accident day?
Right.
And in absence of a film, you have to go to a clearing practitioner or someone who can clearly see into your past.
Right. And she's just helped me facilitate seeing that myself. But she understood clearly where we were going, you know, and so she helped me along to that place. I made the exact same choice that my father, whom I could not forgive, made 50, 55 years earlier, when he opted for the family that he already had, the career that he already had. Finding out about me would have basically been the end of his career in those days, because my parents were married, but not to each other when I was conceived. So while I was regressed, I was only allowed to see my father's face or image and my older brother's face, image, because he had passed away not too long before that. And we had a little conversation. Interestingly, I saw nothing else. It was black. Now, that's not a typical near-death experience. But being that I've studied a lot of ways to get around outside of the body and so forth, and I have some experience with psychic phenomena and so forth, I understand that when things are dark in lucid dreams or regressions, it only means that you're not supposed to see what else is there in this memory or in your experience, because it could change the outcome and remove free will from the equation.
Well, it's not that it removes.
Therefore, you only see what you need to see.
Yeah,
that's where I went.
Well, it is that it empowers you, and then you can make another choice.
Right. And so I made my choice. I made the exact choice that my father had made. I said, basically, cool, Pop. I'd love to stay here with you and Jody, but I kind of like what I have going on over here. Got two sons. Love everything I do. You know, got my place at the beach, you know. I've got a lot going on, and I'll see you later. You know, it wasn't like saying goodbye, but in reality, I did exactly the same thing that he had done. I made the same choice.
And what did you come to that
made? And at that point, I couldn't be angry anymore. How could I? I made the same choice. I just got to see it from a perspective closer to his, and it freed me from all of that crap that I had been carrying around with me for, you know, decades.
That's right.
So that was one thing.
Does.
Yeah, that was one thing that I brought back. The other thing that kept coming to me, especially in the hospital, because so many people came to see me, and I was blown away by the fact that these people would take time out to come and see me. You know, are you okay? You know, that I had not been very kind in my life. I thought of myself as a kind person, but in reflection, I really wasn't. I took people for granted. I tended to look at everything from my perspective and not necessarily from theirs, and oftentimes had treated people like they were just support staff, you know. Yeah, yeah, you're in my movie. You're over there. I don't really need to look at you. Keeping people at a distance, not acknowledging them. Not just smiling and saying thanks for being right here with me in my life. You know?
Yep, I do.
And now, I have not conquered that, but I'm more aware of it, and I'm working on it. I've had a few slips where I've been fairly unkind in the not-too-distant past, but I'm working on it still.
We have these interpersonal relationships with other people, but we also have our own gig, you know? We got our own thing going on.
I'm busy creating my reality right here. That's something I wanted to ask you. Just as a physicist, when you're talking about space, like personal space, how far do you figure you and I would have to get close to each other, like 3 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet, before our realities start to collide, where they meet up?
Well, according to Merkaba research, mm-hmm. it is 27 and a half feet. There's a 55-foot radius around your sphere of energy. But I have to say that when you put your dream, your intention out into the future or out into another space, everything and everyone who will resonate with that idea begins vibrating.
And they show up.
Well, sometimes they do because they still have their own choice to make. They can either respond to that vibration or they cannot. But inanimate objects have no choice.
Right.
They must vibrate with that intention. So your sphere of influence can transcend time and space. But as far as your two realities colliding, I would say that you'd have to be putting your dream or your intention into the same space somewhere around 55 feet in diameter.
Okay. Yeah, I was just, you got me thinking about four things at once. I should probably explain, most people don't know this about me, but I have Asperger's syndrome. If you put me through the tests for Asperger's and the autism spectrum disorder, I am 1 point away from fully autistic. Now, I'm not sure how I managed to get from being born with Asperger's, which of course no one even knew about at that time, to this point in time, but somehow I found a way to survive in the world that made sense. And my family were so results-driven that what I began to see life as was a kind of an obstacle course, and that I clearly didn't understand the rules. I could see that my thinking didn't really match up with the thinking thought patterns of other people. But that didn't matter to me. The point was to survive. I went, okay, this is a game, and it's a game of survival. So I just set about learning all the rules of how to survive. I didn't necessarily learn a lot. I just learned rules how to survive because people with Asperger's, their neurotransmitters do not take the same forks in the road that a lot of other, that your average person, which there really is no such thing, but the average person, you know, whose thought processes are not too neurotic, psychotic, or schizophrenic, you know, their neurotransmitters kind of follow the same path set out by DNA, you know, in all of us. But for a person with Asperger's, their brain space is as cell structured as short-term memory on a computer. And if one of the cells is corrupted or you make the wrong turn, and it can be brought about by just a term, the way I understand a term and the way you understand it could be two different things, and then you continue on with your conversation thinking we're both still talking about the same thing, and the person with Asperger's has gotten stuck on that corrupted cell. It's permanently corrupted, can't be defragged, and at that point you have to stop and try to figure out, where did I go wrong? See? And so it puts people with Asperger's sometimes really behind other people, sometimes puts you really out in front of people. You know, like in my radiology classes, the first question that the professor asked was a math question that included converting fractions and decimal points and everything to get to the power and the intensification of the light that you need to get this, you know, radiation through the film and, you know, so forth and so on. And it was a pretty complex mathematical equation. And he says, you know, by the time he was done saying it, I said the answer. I didn't have a clue how I came up with it, but it was right.
Yeah, I know. I know exactly what you mean. Anyway, that's extremely cool. You know,
it's good to know yourself, to know that about yourself. Yeah, you know, so people stumble into each other so much, and they just stay in their own little cocoon, that 3-foot space where they feel safe. You know, autism spectrum disorder people usually don't feel safe in very many places because they've got that different roadmap in the cerebellum there telling them which way to go. Did you go through any of that in your awakening?
No.
Readjusting?
But as I was growing up, now that you say what you said and you've informed me of what that syndrome is, I probably had so many growing up, I don't know what they are, but
right.
I found myself constantly having to go control alt delete, you know, just to try to reset things and get it going. And I guess I found a way to work around it by just running simultaneous programs all the time and then not letting anyone outside my body know that everything's running all at the same time in my mind.
Right.
I just learned to.
That's right. That's part of the survival mechanism, you know, just to keep things to ourselves. Because the world, and this brings me to what I actually. We've been working up to something here.
I need to take a quick break here, and in the break, as the music is winding down from the break, I'm going to read the poem that you sent me called "The Cell." If that's okay with you,
it is okay with me.
All right.
Are you going to preface it, or just read it and then discuss it?
Yeah, read it and then discuss it.
Okay.
Let me play some music. We'll take a quick 4-minute break. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. My wonderful guest, Mona Lee. Don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio after this. X Squared Radio. My name is Brooks Agnew. My guest tonight is the indomitable, indefeatable Mona Lee. And she wrote this wonderful poem called The Cell. The cell. And she stops at the cell of illusion, where he sits alone in the dark, key in hand, prisoner to his own device. She stands, casting a look of pure love. Eternity is held in a single moment. A beam of light is reflected through the tear on her cheek, but he turns away, giving himself to his fearful creations. Her shroud turns to wings. She looks to the sky, and she's gone. For even though she touched him, he knew her not. Mona will be back in 30 seconds with us. I want to let you know how much we appreciate you being here with us live, February 26, 2012, in an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. If you're listening by archive, you might want to go back and listen to this one again. We're going to open some windows and going to open some doors. Some of you may have to go through those windows and doors to discover the memories of your own self. Because that's what we're doing. We're exploring. As you're making your plans for this year, don't forget about Maya 2012. Don't forget to join us down at Chichen Itza, December 13th through the 22nd. And we'll continue this hour, my guest, the indomitable, indefeatable Mona Lee. Welcome back, Mona.
Thank you so much, Brooks, and thank you for letting me tag along with you here. This is great fun.
It is.
The Chichen Itza thing, I've got to tell you. You said Carlos Santana is supposed to be there. I love Carlos. I know him. He is amazing. You know that field of energy that we were talking about?
Yeah.
He is one of the few people that I've met on the planet that you can feel coming. Like about 50 feet out, you feel them before they ever show up in the room. And in the music industry, lots and lots of stories, you know, we all like to tell about each other, and, you know, that's all kind of gossipy fun, you know. So I had heard things, you know, about Carlos, but when I met him, I found him to be, he elevated the vibration of everyone in the room when he walked in. And he did that consistently. It didn't just happen once. I've been to social engagements, backstage at shows and things like that with Carlos. Very generous, but he practically floats into the room. You know, he looks 8 feet tall just because his aura is that big. You know, so it doesn't surprise me that he has the followers that he does, because he resonates with so many people. And the reason that he does is because he's centered. He knows who he is. He got a clue. And he's using his music to share that with people. And so it comes from what I believe to be a pretty pure place of creativity, you know, and of giving, you know, to become that good at your art.
There
and
are
share
musicians.
It with people and have it mean something to them in their lives.
Yeah.
There are
musicians and then there are artists.
Right.
And,
that's
and
true.
The one thing about Carlos is he's so blessed to be both, because
right.
he's such a creator. And when you listen to him play, or you pick up his old albums and listen to them, you see how he changed music with his art. When
right.
he stepped into music and he makes it happen, he makes it come out of him. And
well,
sometimes,
he makes it come out of everybody else around him, too. He kind of insists on that,
right.
I've noticed.
Everybody resonates with it. Even, and it doesn't matter how many times I listen to his songs, I find something else that he put into that music. Some little lick, some little thing he did with his hands. That
sure. Because artists are always expanding their art.
You know, but when I've known artists that were not great musicians, they could create, right? But it took somebody else to take that creation and really make it move people. But Carlos can do both.
Yeah, he can do both. I think I'm more of an interpreter and a repeater because I love to sing. I love to play my different instruments. But I don't believe that I have that gift that he chose for himself. And that my contribution, although it may seem like much less, is still relevant to what's going on in the world right now. And, you know, I've made a study of a lot of different things in my life because the reason that I told you the Asperger story is because there's nothing more uncomfortable for a person with Asperger's than to have something not make sense and to be unable to figure out how to make it make sense. That's where you get stuck again in one of those cells.
We call it mathematics. I mean, there is crying math.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm looking around at the world. This is before and after the near-death experience. And nothing makes sense. Just nothing. I can find almost nothing on this planet other than the spectacular beauty of nature that makes sense to me, especially where people are concerned. So all of these 6-7 billion souls are here scrambling around, making a great big mess, and nobody's cleaning it up. Nobody seems to even know how. And so I would get stuck along the way. Well, why isn't this working? Well, this makes sense. You know, you look at things like The Secret, and the movie that our friend Michal Ledwith had a big hand in, What the Bleep Do We Know? So you've got these very talented, gifted, intelligent people putting the answer right out in front of everyone. And a majority of people get really excited about it, and yet we still have a miasmic stew of garbage with the people on the planet.
But I think most of this, like What the Bleep Do We Know and The Secret, they do a good job of articulating the question. Because a lot of people, yeah, that's my question too.
Exactly.
But tools for coming up with the answer, that's what was missed.
That's what I want. I want the answer. Question, sure. You can't get anywhere without asking the right question. But I also want the answer. You know? I don't want to sit on this fence forever. I'd like to know what's the formula? What's the golden mean? How do I get there from here? How do we as a society get to that critical mass point where there are more light workers who see this dimension reality that we live in as beautiful, loving, joyful, and unlimited on every level and get it away from the maniacs? You know, Bill Hicks said, you know, the gifts, the gurus, you know, that come back from the other side and tell us about reality and this is just a ride and everything, you know, they come back and they tell us and we kill those people. We let the demons run amok. So I'm looking for that point where the 100th monkey kicks Pavlov's dog and we hit that critical mass where the two worlds, the two realities, the duality, the darkness and the light, make their separation, bid each other adieu, if you will.
Well, and that's what the whole 2012 thing was about, that there'll come this grand division, that the two frequencies will begin to become bimodal in this reality, which we call Earth, that there'll be a vibrational mode, a mode called light, and there'll be a vibrational mode called darkness or fear or doubt or jealousy or anger or terror. And the two will become separated so clearly that by December 21st, 2012, the Earth will literally separate.
Right.
It will go to two Earths. One will go back through the union of the polarity, like we wrote in the Arc of Millions of Years, and the other will stay behind in the third dimension. But the two will gradually and more increasingly become unaware of each other.
Sure. You're shifting your frequency and moving into another dimension.
Yeah.
It sounds simple.
It does, but I'm watching it happen, and it doesn't have to be from a specific guru. I was in an event last night, which was filled with people who said they were Baptists. And I asked an intelligent question, Mona. I said, hey, what's a Baptist? And they go, what do you mean? We believe in the Bible. And I said, well, wait a minute. I got a follow-up question here. What's the difference between a general, a free will, a first, a third, a missionary, I need to understand, because all these different Baptists believe something different.
Right.
Even though they preach from the same Bible. They didn't have a clue. But that wasn't the point, Mona. The point was they started, bearing testimony from the microphone later on in the night.
Right.
Guess what they were talking about? Vibration.
Sure.
They were talking about manifestation. They were talking about light and darkness. They were talking about the same thing that we talk about, but from a spiritual point of view, without all the religious trappings. And I went, oh, my goodness.
Right.
The division is happening right before my eyes.
Even
people that are locked into religiosity are beginning to separate from the dogma of their religion.
Right. That's right. Well, words are the great facilitator of duality. And I believe that we came here or ended up here. I might have lost a bet. I don't know. But we ended up on this planet specifically to experience duality. That's it. And once you figure it out, that's when you move on to doing something else.
Oh, come on. After we figure it out, then the game is, okay, your game's over. Get out of here.
No. I'm sure we leave when we plan to leave and all that stuff. But shifting a dimension, once you get past it, then it's just like, it's like Michal says about the mystery schools and Egypt and all that stuff. You overcome the illusions. And the words are the great separators of and communication. It's the great separator of us. It's what creates the illusion of separateness. It's the us versus them. And this is the way, and I don't want to come right out and say, yes, I believe there's an Illuminati, and they've like David Icke will give you names and bloodlines and all that. So I'm in one of those bloodlines. I didn't buy me a seat at the table.
We come from ancient Scottish clans. And
that's right.
It
didn't buy me a spot at that table, but the us versus them paradigm, the one that we're also desperately trying to get out of, is being force-fed to us in mass. Let's just take the United States. Maybe 200 million people get up every morning as the wave of the day moves across the planet. And they're turning on their TV sets, and most of them tune into mainstream media, garbage. And what do they get? They are force-fed war, insecurity, financial lack, division, us versus them, gay versus straight. And then, just when you can't feel any less safe in your own world from listening to this garbage, after you first wake up, because, of course, if it bleeds, it leads in media. So you get to wake up and see horrible things happening to people. Then when they take a break, they're going to sell you cancer. They make commercials that make it look appealing to go to the Cancer Center of America.
Yeah.
So you get 3 minutes of that and how you're going to get cholesterol. Not only is it an unsafe world, but you're not safe and you're not getting out of here alive. Now tell me, please, what as a mass mind are we going to manifest when we're all together now imaging war, famine, bombing this, stealing that, little girls getting abducted? What are we going to see when we wake up tomorrow exactly what we manifested today with our thoughts, with our visions. It's the image. That's the thing they don't tell you in the secret and the other things. It's the image, not the thought.
Right, but the news gets played over and over and over again, and what happens is you end up reflecting that stuff out in your consciousness.
You can't not reflect it because you just woke up, so you're not far from the sleep state, right? You're still a little bit in there between the worlds, and, which is a great time to manifest. It's why people who know what they're doing put on, you know, their favorite soft music and go sit outside in nature as opposed to turning on the TV and getting scared to death. You know, that some rabid AIDS-infested pit bull is going to attack you as you step out your door, you know. They make that step, their own step, to go, well, I'm not going to listen to that today. Because as I image that in my mind and then I boost it through, just like radiology, you know, the emotion is the power behind the template, which, of course, is the image that's on the film of your brain, you know, so you're going to push that energy, just like that radiation, through the film out into your reality, and since everything is pretty much in a big bubble, you know, I'm in my own bubble, you're in your own bubble, and then we're all in this big bubble together. You push that through, that's the image that is going to come back to you. That's the reality you're going to create because you were feeling horrible. You were in the lowest dimensions, you know, of anger and loss of control and depression. What can I do? What can one man or woman do to change all these problems with the world? And they run them past you every 15 seconds. These people died. That boat capsized. This poor woman just lost her life to, you know, prescribed medications. You know, that's what you get fed, and you don't know what to do, but you believe it. And then so you invest all this emotion with the image in your mind, you send it out there, and when it comes back to you, it's coming back exactly like what you sent out. More war, more distress, more poverty, less jobs, people not solving problems. That's the point, but, you know.
Part of it, Mona, is this stream of mis and disinformation. Because a lot of that news isn't true. It's fabricated. It's written like a script. You know, when we talk about Afghanistan, if I mention that to somebody, the first word that comes out of their mouth is oil. And the second one is Al-Qaeda. And I go, wait a minute, there's no oil in Afghanistan. They have no oil wells. And the Al-Qaeda has been gone for 2 years. They don't even exist.
Afghanistan has lithium, the largest deposit of lithium on the planet.
Yeah, but they're not mining it. Afghanistan is run by the Taliban, which is nothing more than a drug cartel. I asked somebody the question today, do you think we'll ever defeat the Mexican drug cartels? And they said, no. I said, why? They said, because there's too much money in drugs. You could go down and wipe them all out, and they'll be replaced in 24 hours with another group. I said, that's exactly what's happening in Afghanistan. The Taliban are heroin pushers. And they're not talking about millions. They're talking about billions of dollars.
Right. So the owners of this country are the ones who insist, and the owners of the media, they keep mankind and society in this constant fight or flight battle between us versus them.
Yeah,
the drug dealers and the cartels and the Afghanistan. Doesn't matter who they are.
Yeah, but the us is what I'm getting at. The us is Christianity, and the them is radical Islam.
And in that particular case.
No, it's drugs. It's heroin. They grow poppy. They don't want to mine lithium. They want to do drugs. Drugs is the money of the Middle East.
Ah. Well, my point is that there's a duality to fight about around every corner. All you have to do is turn on your computer or the news or the radio or anything, and all you're going to see is duality that looks like it can never be ended. And what I'm saying is there is a point of critical mass where light workers and people who understand that it's the images in their mind. John Lennon had it right. Imagine it. Don't think about it. Don't stand around all day reading affirmations about how I'm wealthy, I'm healthy, I'm this, that, and the other thing. No, it's the image in our minds. That's the template. That's the negative on the film. And until we step, till we get enough people to step over to the light side, if you will, out of the darkness into the light, you can see if you look at my music work that a lot of what I've written follows a lot of what I've been learning in Druidry or whatever else that I was studying at the time. And so for me and my music and putting out that video for World Intention Day on February 22nd, which incidentally I decided to do every month on the 22nd now, and I took out a little domain that I haven't built yet called World Peace 22 or something like that. The point is for you and me and everyone who hears this or thinks of it or wants to change their own vibrations and to refuse to accept the gift of Murdoch and the creeps that want to keep us all enslaved to drugs and everything, duality and everything else, and instead focus their mind and their hearts on the beauty, the joy, the love that's our reality. And that's where that's when the split will come between the two worlds. And that's what the poem The Cell was about. About a man and a woman. That is about the male-dominated patriarchy, drugs pushing, warmongering, give me a bigger gun energy.
Oh yeah, the folks down at Wars R Us are saying
right. and the female energy, which is what is coming back in. This I think goes around about every 3,500 years. We switch. The polarity between the male and female, patriarch and matriarch, and I'm not making a judgment, just saying it's different, it's the same but different. I'm hoping that, and it's just one little thing, it's 5 minutes, but it's my contribution of my song, my voice, my music, my thoughts, my photos and some other photos that I found, just to put my foot on the other side of that pinnacle that splits the two worlds from positive and negative. So it's just me working with my art to put it out there to say this is the way I see it. You know?
When we talk about this pyramid of creative power that you talk about, in the big fat bottom of it, we have hate and fear, and in the pinnacle point of it, you have joy and faith.
Right.
And you know, our good friend Michal will tell you that the intensity, the amplitude, the volume level of hate and fear is very loud. It's about 40 times louder than the energy of joy and faith. That's why they call it the still small voice, I guess. But.
Yeah.
You make up for it with the number of speakers.
Right.
So you get a very loud signal of hate and fear coming out of one set of loudspeakers. But if you have 10 million small speakers that are projecting joy and faith, it completely drowns out the hate and fear.
It does. Absolutely. That's my point. And so, you know, bless his heart. We haven't talked much about James Gilliland, and you and I have both had life-altering experiences up at his ranch. And I'd like to say thank you, James, because James has so many people who like to follow his work and the work of Esetti and all the people that like to go up to the ranch and experience the UFOs and the fairies and the orbs. And that is just such a wonderful place on Earth. But it was because of James that my video got, instead of getting, 50 views on YouTube, got closer to 6,000. because that's how many people follow him.
Right? Yeah.
And so bless his heart. I've got to say that James, for anyone who doesn't know him, and anyone who likes to say, you know, like people like to smart off on comments on Facebook and YouTube and make judgments and stuff about James because he's different, you know, and not afraid to show it. He just says it like it is. That's what you get. When you meet James, what you see is what you get. He is the gentlest soul. You know, he doesn't have it in him to try to propagate a falsehood on other people because he understands clearly that he is only propagating that ill will on himself. He lives from a point of oneness. He's one of the few people on the planet that sees everything as one. He lives that reality. He spends time in the higher dimensions. And, of course, Michal would correct me and say, no, things are not stratified in such a way. You know, they're really horizontal, not vertical, but, you know, as far as energies and stuff. But the majority of people on the planet see a pyramid, you know, and that's the way that the actual power of that pyramid is reversed. If you look at that picture of the pyramid and you see joy at the top and hate at the bottom should really be tiny. And the top, where the joy and the faith and the belief and the happiness, laughter, our natural state of enjoying our spiritual trip through the human reality here, that should be gigantic because that's the bigger energy. So even in that, once again, what do we have? The perfect dichotomy. It's black being white, light being dark. That's this earth, I'm telling you, this dimension, it's duality and that's all it is. That's the hump. And when you get off the fence, you're either going to go over to, you know, the light side that makes, you know, you feel the truth of your being, or you're going to step on the other side and fall into the abyss with the, you know, the guys that like to make guns and bombs or something, you know.
Or you do what most people do, and that is
stay on the fence,
Monday through
come
Saturday.
Back over and over.
Yeah, Monday through Saturday night, you're over on the devil's side listening to the music and having all manner of debauchery, and then Sunday morning, you go in and try to get cleansed of it all, and you enjoy the day and the Sabbath and all that, and then Monday morning you start all over again. But as time goes on, the chasm between light and darkness, and I'm not talking about...
light.
No, I'm talking about the chasm, because the fence that you talk about becomes a line, becomes a street, becomes a town, becomes a chasm. And sooner or later, you have to make a choice. You're going to be on one side or you're going to be on another. And much right. like the ancient scriptures would say, you know, judge not that you be not judged, lest you be judged with that judgment. What they're trying to say in that scripture is you are your own judge by the energy level that you assume.
Right.
I can't go bouncing along listening to grunge all day long, headbanging and tattooing yourself and getting high.
Did you put a camera in my kitchen or something? No, I'm kidding.
No, but then you can't just all of a sudden jump over to the other side because the chasm is going to get too wide. You're
going to
find yourself squinting, like walking out of a movie theater into the broad sunlight. You're going to be out of element.
The chasm becomes the abyss, and when you look into the abyss, it looks back into you. That's what the chasm becomes. That's the abyss. It's a thing that you have to be willing to step into, even though you can't see what you're going to land on. Sometimes that, you know, that's the choice. You just have to take it because you know it's right. And you go, well, okay, you know, I would liken it to, what was it, Indiana Jones, which incidentally, for anyone who doesn't know, Brooks, true life Indiana Jones, only really, really, really smarter. But, you know, when you look into that, doggone it, Brooks, I lost my place. I went to three places at once and then turned around and they were all gone. I'm not sure how I got lost on my point. But the Indiana Jones movie, The Last Crusade, where he has to step out into what looks like a death jump, right? And he puts his foot out because he sees the drawing in the book of the knight holding his foot out that he's going to step into this abyss. And it's the only way he can save his father. He has no choice. He has to ask himself, what do you believe? And then take the step, even though he has no idea whatsoever what's going to catch him. And that, I think that's the way most people feel, when they have to, because it's easy. It's easy. It's an addiction. The chemicals that get released in the human body with all that death and doom and gloom every morning become addictive. And you say, well, that makes no sense whatsoever. Well, it makes perfect sense. Because whenever you're faced with fight or flight on one side or, say, perfect lovemaking on another side, your body just gets flushed with all these endorphins and various chemicals and things. And bad things become addictive. They fit hand in glove with the behavior, and you become addicted to the drama. And staying addicted to your drama keeps you safe. It might not be fun.
I was an engineer at Nissan. Nissan at the time was about 52 acres under roof. We had about 4,800 employees at the time. And we were just getting ready to launch the Altima. And 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. I need to go way back. First Gulf War. Not the second Gulf War. We go to invade Iraq because they've taken over Kuwait. That's what it was. So prior to 1991, it was news at 11. We got 30 minutes of national news, 30 minutes of local news, and then it was back into gun smoke.
Right.
But when we started flying assets over to Kuwait, a little tiny obscure news service called CNN down in Atlanta decided to go 24 hours a day covering the war. Now, at Nissan, we had about 1,200 25-inch color TVs, and they were mounted all over the planet. And what we broadcasted on those was the thing we called Nissan News Network. And we talked about quality aspects and different employees and things like that. When that war began, all the 25-inch TVs in the entire plant ran CNN. And it was addicting. 24-hour news was born because people put it down.
Because they feed this stuff to us like with a spoon and sugar like it's good for us. And we accept it because it is the social norm. There's all the dogma. And then, you know, out of a sense, of course, of wanting to be one with God, but also, you know, just give me a two-hour break from this stuff. You know, a lot of people crowd into churches and because it's the only place that they can feel any sense of hope. And then they go right back out. Well, then they go to the bar and they get drunk because they know that they don't really believe in the hope. You know, they just like the two-hour, illusion that there's some hope out there and they just haven't gotten it all yet, you know. And then they go get drunk and do all the other stuff they do, and the next morning they get up and they turn that crap on again. And it becomes the way of life, and it affects everything because the people who own this country and who own this planet and who push the wars and the military-industrial complex, and who tell you that the occult is, going to get you sent to hell while you're going to burn forever because God loves you and that's going to be good for you. People end up staying in that darkness because, for one thing, it keeps getting fed to them, and therefore it keeps creating more of that darkness. But it's easier to sometimes stay with the maniac that you're used to living with than walking out the door to something completely unknown. When I did the work in the Bay Area for the support network for battered women, I had to go through a lot of hours of training, sensitivity training, because most people don't understand why a woman would stay with a man who would beat her up. Doesn't make any sense. Didn't make any sense to me. Looked like something I needed to know more about. I was going to put my time into that and my education. So I went in, did an internship, took all these hours of study, and I learned so much. One of the things that I learned was that the average woman, even though men are often abused too, the average woman or a person who's being abused leaves their abuser 7 to 12 times before they stay gone. Just like when you were giving one of your, I think a couple of years ago, you were doing your presentation and you were talking about the golden mean and the rule of eight. Isn't it eight times that you have to do something before it manifests?
That's right.
Right. And that's when I began to get that. No, you don't do it just once. You don't do it just twice. When you reach a point where you want to change your paradigm, the universe is going to give you every opportunity to prove you mean what you say. So let's just say, you know, that this, let's just take the abused woman, for instance. She finally says, I've had enough. I'm not staying for any more of this. This is going to kill me. It's not right. I'm leaving. The first thing the universe is going to do is put a little test out there and go, really? Is that what you want? Because that's not what you're doing. You're still in the house. See? The universe only reflects back to us the energy we're putting out there. And so you say that, but this is completely different than what this woman's been doing for the last 8 or 10 years. So if you really want to manifest this, the universe is going to give you the test. You know, you really want to understand this? Here's your first chance. And you will make your reality out of what you do with that opportunity. Some people get it the first time, and they go. But most people have to make the choice many times before they actually, before the manifestation, you know, before the, you know, what is it? All mass is just energy condensed to a slow vibrational rate. And what you're actually going to do is change your vibrational rate. That's why music is so helpful in healing. Because it changes your vibration, literally. That's why putting out a video like my little World Intention video is so important, because it combines music, tones, vibrations, ideas, and things, images that are peaceful and happy, right? You kind of have to practice it before you know, it's a new pair of shoes. You got to walk in them for a while.
Well, you know? That and the whole idea about doing it eight times is once you add energy to a specific slope of numbers, specific
right.
What we call, you know, a Fibonacci increase.
That,
or
right. I love the whole Fibonacci thing. Love it.
A Phoenix increase, you get the slope of the golden mean, and the universe begins to resonate with your manifestation.
Everything
and by
does.
The way, it works for good or for ill. So if you want to manifest mayhem, you can do that too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for people have asked me why I, instead of Wicca, I went for Druidry. And there are two main differences. And please don't send me any emails. Wicca, to me, seemed like it was more about spell casting to create your own reality. Druidry seemed to me to be more about becoming one with the earth and your environment and allowing that energy to unfold harmoniously. It was less about trying to make something happen and more about trying to flow with the energies that you want, that you feel more comfortable with. If, for instance, I was born in Southern California. I now live practically in the middle of a forest because I get along a lot better with trees than people. You know, I had to move away from where I was in order to relax and vibrate at the level that was more comfortable f- for me to work in. You see? So, I have a question for you on the Fibonacci sequence. Some while back, I don't know when, they changed in music. It's now based on a scale of a vibration of A440. So that the A note that you would strike on a piano or on a bass guitar, on a guitar or whatever, will resonate at the same vibration, 440, what is it, megahertz, whatever, you know, per second or whatever. Prior to that, it had not been 440. It was like 432 or something. And one, I'd like to know who made the change and why, because I think it could have a lot to do with having us all just a little too out of sync to comfortably figure out bigger questions. Does that make any sense to you?
Sure, it does. And I don't know who changed it or why, but I do understand the difference.
Right.
And the difference specifically has to do with harmonics.
Right.
And the idea is that vibrations, when they're in harmony, they sound beautiful, and they turn on molecular combinations inside the human body, not the least
right.
of which is own DNA.
Yep.
440 is dissident to that.
That's right.
So we can make harmonies with it because we retune the whole scale of music. It's
right.
dissident to the biology. Now, I know there are some groups out there who are retuning their instruments, all of them in the band, to an A432 or an A428. I've heard that as well. I think Len Horowitz says that.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that this is the vibration of love or the vibration of peace or something.
I believe it's also the vibration of the earth. The earth rings like a bell, as you know very well.
Sure.
It makes a great big sound that we don't hear, but it's there. And just like earthquakes make great big sounds, and unless you're standing where the energy splits the crust of the planet, you're not going to know anything about it. I've been there where in the Loma Prieta earthquake, which is why I don't live in the Bay Area anymore, because I was standing in one of those spots where the Loma Prieta earthquake happened, and all that sound came up and ricocheted off of this rock and that granite and this mud and came out where I was standing and split the foundation. I was on a slab foundation in a condominium, split that cement concrete right under my feet. So as you can imagine, I didn't have a happy ride. It wasn't fun. And I got trapped in the house. But I do believe that the correct, whether it's 432 or 438, whatever it is the sound. It resonates properly with the vibration of the planet. Just my opinion.
Yep. I think you're dead on. I'm going to start looking up these bands, and there's several of them out there that have retuned all their instruments to this this new A. And I'm going to start listening to that music and see what it does. By the way, our phone number is 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America, toll-free. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, it's 530-413-6472. If you have any information on this, who retuned it and when it was retuned to 440 and why, that would be great. But also, if you have a listing of any of the musicians or bands out there or production companies out there that are retuning their instruments to the original A frequency, I would appreciate it. bagnew@x2-radio.com if you've got that. Maybe my producer knows. I don't know. He has a lot of hosts on BBS Radio Network, and I'm sure somebody out there has spoken about this. Now you got me going, Mona. I got to go do some research. Now I've made notes.
I told you I would try to answer or ask good questions. I hope I've asked a couple of good questions
so far. That's good. You know, one of the things that I noticed when I read the book, The Secret, and I listened to the stuff from What the Bleep Do We Know,
uh-huh.
I got to admit, I ran out and bought magazines and scissors and refrigerator magnets, and I turned my refrigerator into an intention machine.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, nothing happened. But I also have to admit that I have tried with the tools of my book, Remembering the Future, and it worked. I got the motorcycle I wanted. I got the truck that I wanted. I got the job that I wanted.
I remember that motorcycle.
Yeah.
Tell me, say it again, because there's motorcycle riders out there who will love that story. Tell the motorcycle story.
Okay, I decided that I wanted a motorcycle. I rode one when I was young, and then I had kids, and so I was the super dad for 25 years, raised
right.
my kids, and you know the oldest one is you know now a senior in college, and everything's you know I'm no kids at home, so
right.
I decided I want to get a bike and you know take care of me for a while.
Sure.
So I said, what kind of bike do I want? Well, I had to be very specific because. You know, remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel is about dreaming very specifically. So I said, okay, I want a Honda Shadow, and I want it to be, I want it to have less than 4,000 miles on it, and I want to spend less than $6,000 on it. Well, yeah, all my friends said, yeah, fat chance, you're not going to find that. So, or maybe it was the other way around. Less than 6,000 miles and less than $4,000.
I think that was it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah. everybody said, oh, you're nuts. Oh, I said,
you're
no, there's,
yeah.
there's more. I want it to be purple. I've never
right,
seen a purple.
That's right. Yeah. That's what got me. And I want it to be purple. Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, and then I released. I let it go. I didn't ring it every day. I didn't go shopping every day. But I had this thought, and every time I saw a motorcycle go by, I went, ah, yeah, you know. And the feeling would just come again and again and again. And sure enough, I opened up eBay one day, clicked over, let's just take a look. Honda Shadow 1100, bingo, eBay. There is a 1996 purple Honda Shadow 1100 with less than 6,000 miles on it. For $3,996, I said, there's no way that can be right.
I love that story. It's so perfect.
It listed 2 hours before I opened the page.
Right?
I clicked
and then,
buy.
And then you just got the feeling that you should go look.
Yeah, and guess what? The darn thing was only 60 miles away. Okay. I drove over to Johnson City, Tennessee, and the most interesting story. Because this was in 1996, and I bought it in 2005, so she's 9 years old. So I go over there, and it's this young kid. He's like 21, maybe 21, 20 and a half. And he just got married. And he said, yeah, I've got this bike, and it's outside, and it's under a cover. And he uncovers it, and there's not a scratch on it. It's pristine clean. I said, why the low miles? And his wife said, well, he had two motorcycles. He bought a dirt bike, which he owned, and he rode. And then he bought this from a doctor who only rode it on Sundays. And he then shattered his ankle driving the dirt bike, and it took 6 months to heal. They had to do all kinds of stuff to it to get it, and it finally got out of the cast. And then his wife, and then they got married in the meantime, and his wife said, you are selling that bike.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to sell it. If you don't sell it, I'm going to. So she is the one that put it on eBay for less than it was worth. She didn't know what it was. And I'm the guy that bought it like 2 hours later.
Apparently and she had a lot of faith in that marriage.
Yeah. Well, I've been riding that bike since. So
if somebody that I was with put something I loved dearly on eBay and didn't ask me first, they'd be out the door and there wouldn't be anything but little bits of smoke following them as they went out, you know. But it was perfect. Perfect for you.
Yeah.
So
I write it, you know, every time the weather gets above 49 and a half degrees and sunny.
I learned a great trick. And incidentally, I learned that releasing thing in Druidry. That's one thing I learned there is, yes, Druids can manifest. Yes, they can, you know, the wizards. Yes, you can make things happen. You can make them appear and all that. There's various ways to do those things. But one of the things that I learned was to let go of it. Okay, you've conjured up your vision. you know, whatever it is that you want or circumstance or whatever it is, and then you release it. Because if you don't release it, you're going to disturb the frequency, vibration, and the energy that you conjured it up with, and probably with the energy of doubt. And you start flipping that doubt in there and wondering, well, how is it going to happen? Where is it going to be? What do I have to, you know, that changes all the energy. So you decide what it is you're going to create, and then you let it go. And I also learned that just a cute little magic trick. For instance, I wanted a new house. I wanted a new place to live one time. And I was studying all this stuff and just couldn't stay where I was at anymore. And I had no money, really, to speak of, certainly not to buy a home with. I was barely employed. And really, you know, I don't know what I was thinking that I could manifest a new place to live. But what I wanted was a new place that I could afford to pay cash for and could have within a week with probably a real crappy credit score, too. You know, so I wasn't asking for much.
You picked the color, size, and what the surroundings would be, and your friend said, Mona, get real.
No, what I did is I went out, someone told me in like a New Age bookstore, go buy something for that house, for your new abode.
Yeah. After event. You concentrated on the after event.
That's right. That's the imaging. And I'll tell Brooks, in 1 week, I had a 40-foot fifth wheel set up in a park, perfect for me, really low space rent, great location. I was able to pay cash for it because an unexpected check came in for exactly the amount of money I needed to pay cash for that place.
And
I was moved. I moved in because I bought a poster. Now, you got to believe that poster is still the mainstay in one of my major rooms in my house to remind me that when you want something, you buy something for it. You want a new house, buy a key. Carry it with you. This is the key to my new house. And then you picture what it is. I'm telling you, it worked. That stuff works. I love it.
That was great. I love that. That's great. And that's key to it is, you know, we talk about in the book about ringing the bell, and then you got to take your hand off the bell.
You do.
You got to let it ring. If you keep holding on to it, it's only going to make a thud.
Well, the real power in music is in the spaces, not the notes. It's in the silence between the notes and the beats. That's what makes it music. If you were hit, you know, a guitar chord, you know, and you strum a guitar chord and you never do anything else, that's not a song. There's nothing happening with it. There's some vibration going on, but it's not going to take you anywhere. It's probably not going to inspire you to dance. It's the spaces that make the music great.
I love it. It's the downbeat. It's the rhythm that just
it is.
You know, makes the biorhythm make it so interesting.
Are you familiar with the Neville Brothers band? Aaron Neville, the Neville Brothers. They're like the mainstay of New Orleans, you know, music, real true American music that was born in Congo Square. You know,
I've been to New Orleans many times, and I
cannot be still to their music. Just can't be. If I, you know, I go, God, I haven't heard them in a long time. I go put them on. I'm dancing. I could be on crutches, but if their music's on, I'm dancing. I can't be still to what they do, and they're extremely hip to creating your own reality because they got that whole voodoo thing going on. They have combined their voodoo, their cultures, their religions, their Catholicism, their iconography, you know, they've combined it all into their reality, and it resonates, and a lot, most people who hear it just can't be still. You know, it's genius. It's like one song. It's like four or five or six or seven bodies, but one musical soul. They're all doing the same thing, and they don't even have to talk about it. It just happens. Well, they're family, most of them, for one thing. But you know, that is one of the greatest experiences that I've ever had in my life, and it doesn't happen very often. I've been exquisitely fortunate to play with music with certain people. I always try to surround myself with people that are better than I am so that I can learn, and I'm always grateful when they let me in, even if it's just for a minute or a song or whatever. It is one of the great gifts of life to find two or three or four other people that you're a musical soulmate with, you know, that group at that time. It's just the right group of people at the right time, and it's an incredible gift. And when the band is on and the energies are right, all the people are there, and you're playing like you've never played before and you don't even know why, I swear the whole band starts to levitate. It's an experience that can't be bested by much of anything. Galactic sex, maybe, but they're close.
Yeah, more you volume, know? Maybe.
Maybe a little louder, but they're close, yeah. Just an exquisite
experience. To play the band,
and I'm so grateful to people that I've had that a couple of times in my life. It's just magic.
I played in a band in my mid-20s, and the lead singer of that band is still, you know, one of my best friends. Over 30 years we've been doing business, and he still sings. It's so funny because we were at an event somewhere. It was a business event, and they had brought out for intermission a singer-entertainer to try to, you know entertain. There was about 3,000 people in this place. And Butch Elliott, who's the lead singer, was sitting on the aisle, and I was sitting next to him. And the singer had a wireless mic, and he came down into the audience, you know, and he was singing this song. And he was sticking the mic in people's faces, you know, along the aisle, and they were like, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh, you know, it just couldn't hit the note at all. But he was doing it out of courtesy. And I nudged Butch, and Butch made eye contact with the guy, and sure enough, he walked right down the aisle singing a song, sticks the mic in Butch's face. Butch grabs the mic, stands up, and wails that song way better than this guy was singing it. And the whole place came to their feet. It was amazing.
Wonderful.
The voice that this guy had. We were playing a concert one time, and we blew the power. Our lights knocked out the power. And so while we were, you know, shutting off switches and then going to hit the breaker, it took maybe 5 minutes to find the breaker box in the building and turn it back on. You know, the audience is kind of, oh, wow, that's such a downer. And Butch walks out to the front of the stage, no power. The place is dark. There's a few, you know, lights coming under the door or whatever to light the place up.
Right.
And Butch sang a cappella to this place with about 800 people in it, and they heard him. And he sung to them with no music, no lights, no nothing for about 5 minutes.
There must have been some acoustics in that building.
Oh, it was great. It was like singing in a big garbage can. But he was that kind of person. He has that kind of energy. I could tell you that music, when we would get into a song, we would look up to Butch, and he would nod at us, and that meant this is the place where we jam, okay? So we take a 3-minute song and we make it 11 minutes.
Of course.
And we do a round robin of jams, drum solo, bass solo, lead guitar solo. You know, Butch will get out there and wail, pull in some lyrics from some other song and sing it in the middle, and then go right back to the song. And it was magic. Absolute, like you said, levitating magic. It was great.
Yeah, it is. Remember when we're out in the field up at the Field of Dreams up at the East Eddy Ranch, and after all the conferences are over for the day and everybody's had their dinner, and we all start to wander out to the Field of Dreams there at the foot of Mount Adams and wait for whatever spectacular thing is going to present itself out there. When the drumming circle starts,
yeah,
and people start holding hands and humming, and they're singing. It's so primal. I love it. There's another thing that we have here in Vineta. Vineta is the hometown and home base of the Oregon Country Fair. Now, Vineta does not have a single hotel room in it. This is a town of, when I moved here, it was about 1,800 people. By now, there might be 4,000 within the city limits. It's a tiny town. and not a single hotel room, but for about 5 days in July every year, we become a city of 40 to 50,000. And there's this huge fairgrounds just a little bit west of town, the Oregon Country Fair Fairgrounds. And if you were ever a hippie, you must come at some point. It's like the second weekend in July every year. People come from all over the planet to attend, and they have people who give people on stilts, girls wearing nothing but body paint, musicians from all over the world, and the greatest vendors in the world. And so, of course, we have to have a place for all these people to stay, because you cannot camp on the Oregon Country Fair grounds. So this is a three-day festival of music and creativity and laughter and fairy wings, and, you know, it's just like Peter Pan. I'm in Never Never Land. And but then we have to have campgrounds. And so I help a friend of mine every year who has about 13 acres that border the fairgrounds. And so he goes to great lengths to get his property ready for campers, and he opens his field up like Woodstock to the campers, and musicians come in, and we have late night jams, drumming circles. The stuff goes on until 4 or 5 in the morning, and I swear, if you close your eyes and you smell the fire and you hear the other people and the drums, you're in the sway of it. It's like you could be back 20 or 30,000 years. It is so primal. It hits on something so ancient that we all recognize that we possess together. That it's that magic.
Yeah.
It's incredible magic. And music, almost always a part of it.
I am not a drummer, but I have been in the drumming circle. And you're right. I mean, within 5 minutes, you find some kind of groove, either with the maracas or a tambourine or a drum or some kind of clicky thing. He's got like 40
anything, minutes. Anything that makes noise. Grab a box and pound on it. You know, it is just one thing I really enjoyed. Is it? It's not John Kelly. What's the kid's name that brings those electromagnetical devices up there, and we were all in a big circle holding hands, and there was a current.
John Reilly.
What's his name?
It was John Reilly. The big white electromagnetic generator. I think it puts out 5 million volts.
And we were all holding hands, and if you want to get in that circle, you better do it in time. Because it'll be a bit shocking if you don't. Once they've got it going, I walked up to Michal, you know, because I didn't even know what it was, you know, and I saw him out in the field with a bunch of people. I walked over, you know, and I just stood next to him, kind of behind him. I'm looking at him. I'm looking, oh, everybody's got their hands together. And I didn't realize that there was this current going, right? It helps to have all the pieces of the puzzle, and I didn't. And so, you know, I go, hey, I'm on in here, right, you know? Let me in. So he says, well, okay, but we have to do this very carefully, because when you break that current, it can be quite shocking, you know, and people will feel something not too terribly fun, you know. So, but we did it. I got in that circle on time, and it didn't hurt too much. That was another one of those moments, you know, where your whole paradigm, your whole outlook, you know, changes, and you're just going, wow.
Thing in infrared when that happened. And this huge, probably 200 foot tall vortex of orbs opened up above this spiral of people that were holding onto this machine, which is really a great technology. It's a slowly rotating magnetic field that just really, you feel completely euphoric for a couple of days. But this tornado of orbs opened up. It went up about 200 feet, and it went right out of the top of this machine, straight up over the people. And when I put these infrared goggles on, they were filming it, but I put the goggles on, and it was like
a sea of orbs.
Yeah, but there were so many you couldn't see through them.
Right.
A cloud of orbs. It was amazing.
I've taken some orb photos like that. Did you like the picture of the my favorite little orb that I sent you, my orb photography?
Yes.
When I was doing that, before I got a camera that filters all that stuff out, that one orb, that golden, you know, it's small, compact, but very, very luminous light coming out of it, almost like a light bulb. You know, like if it was an orb inhabited, it would have been Tesla, okay, in the orb. That's how bright it was in the photography. I sent you another one of when I first started going up to East SETI, at that time it was called the Bridge House Sanctuary, and was meeting with James, and we were doing clearings and healings and doing the table tipping and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And during one session, my son, Colton, who was about 5 at the time, one of his spirit guides or guardians came through during the session. And I took a picture right after that with just a film, you know, analog type film, old Fuji film camera, of Colton. And when I got the film back, the pictures back, there next to Colton is this being, this flame of light in different colors. You know, it starts out yellow and then it goes to, you know, orange and magenta, everything like the colors of the different chakras, you know, standing right next to him in the film, on the picture. Oh, yeah, that must be that whoever came in there. You know, I love getting that. And, of course, you don't get as much of that with digital. I'm not sure why. I think it's part of it is the infrared filter.
It could be the extra wavelengths of light or whatever. Hey, one of our buddies from a couple of years ago, Mark from Albuquerque, has called in. I want to bring him in. Hey, Mark, how's it going?
Oh, wonderful, bro. How are you? You sound wonderful.
How's your wonderful daughter, Mariah?
She's very well, and she's a mother now, so I'm a grandfather.
How about that? Welcome to the club, my friend.
Congratulations. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Very nice to meet you, Mona.
Nice to meet you too, Mark.
We might have met at the ranch.
You may have.
A couple times. Yes. Oh, and it's so wonderful to hear both you and all your speaking. I wanted to call in because one of our friends who has transitioned came through to me about a week ago or 10 days ago, Auntie Nahi.
Ah.
Hi, Auntie. She's here. Boy, she comes quick, doesn't she?
Excuse me?
She comes quick. She's here. You said her name, yeah. and I got the signal.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, and she pops right around.
It was so beautiful because a young Hawaiian woman came to my door, actually for what I had put out there, which was to change my services as far as internet and telephone, and wasn't going to call. I just put the thought out that, oh, I need to change that. It's getting too expensive on the one I have. And that evening, she arrived, and she was very homesick for Hawaii.
Yeah.
And Nahi came in and says, give her a gift from her homeland. She needs this healing.
And I know Nahi.
Yes.
I know her. She was at the ranch, wasn't she?
Yes. Yes,
yes,
indeed.
I did meet her. That's why she came through so quick. We did speak one year, the last year that she was there. Yeah,
and actually, the gift I gave to the young woman was the gift that Nahi had gifted to me that I've had on my altar for a couple of years now. And you should have seen her aura just flare into rainbows and
the
joy to her face from receiving that gift and being reminded and knowing that she has Aloha Spirit with her always, no matter where she is.
Right.
And then 2 days later, I was on the internet, and someone asked me, says, who was that person? I think she was a kapuna from Hawaii that was on our site. And I said, Auntie Nahi? She said, yes, she came to me the other night.
Wow.
So I guess Nahi's out and about now.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mark, I had a very close friend just pass away on the 22nd, which is the day that I had picked for World Intention Day. And I knew when I decided on that date, I got a little advance notice that this would be the day that my friend would pass. We'd been expecting it for a while. She lived up in British Columbia, and she was so psychic that she really had to go live out in the forest. You know, because she just couldn't be around people because she's so sensitive. And but she was fairly, actually, she was very evolved when she was here, an extremely stoic, spiritual person like Nahi. You know, been here a few times before, probably just came back this time to help other people, you know.
Right.
Probably learned all their own lessons, you know, and came back as what they call in that circle a wounded eagle, someone who has gone through all of their transitions and volunteers to come back to help other people learn their lessons and hurry on the ascension. And it was the same with her. When people are really centered in their spirituality and they're prepared to cross, which I believe both Nahi and my friend Zara were well prepared, Zara was looking forward to it. She said, I can't wait to get out of this body and get out there to the freedom that I no longer have in my body. Where most of us, if we die, we cross over. We loved ones meet us, you know, and they kind of take care of us. It's traumatic. And then you go to review, you know, and review your life plan and all that. Those people like Nahi and Zara, they don't have to go through any of that stuff. They're instantly on the other side, and they're in their freedom, and they're in their true state, and they can zoom around and be a lot of places at once, and it's very easy for them to do.
Yep. They say, you mind if I skip orientation?
That's right. Skip orientation. We're going straight for door number 3 with the e-ticket. Nahi was like that, too, I could tell.
I was telling Mona earlier, you know, when we get here, we're stuck in this biological transducer that can't talk, it can't walk, it can't even wipe its own butt, you know, for a couple of years. And then, you know, by the time we actually step in and become aware, self-aware, we're like 8 or 9 years old, we can't even remember the transition from the other side.
My son, Colton, asked me a great question when he was about 3 or 4. And I put him in the car, and I'm going to my job at the law firm and what have you. And just out of the blue, he says, how do you know which is real? When you're asleep dreaming or when you're awake? Like now.
Wow. Wow.
And I didn't have as good an answer for him then as I would have had now. Now I would, you know, he's saying which is real. If I'd have been on it, I'd have said both.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was ahead of me right then. I was just driving to work, you know. I'm not in the mode, son. Sorry. Got to go out and fight traffic, you know. But, you know, yes, you're absolutely right. We have the wonderment. And then this duality of a world kind of beats it out of us. And when we're old enough to wonder about it again, we don't remember what we were going to ask ourselves, you know. What reality? I want to go do this over here, you know.
I want to make $1 million, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I love that one. Well, why don't you just do what you love, and at least you'll be doing that. And then the money will come or it won't. It doesn't matter. You'll be happy.
It's absolutely true. I mean,
you know, the money will probably come if you're doing what you love. Now in my case, I grew up thinking that I was going to be a superstar. I can look back now at things that happened to keep that from happening and realize I would never have survived it. I did not have the makeup, the emotional strength.
Don't look now, but most superstars don't. A la Whitney Houston, a la blah, 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 blah. They don't survive.
Right.
And Mona?
Yeah.
Look how bright you're shining now.
Aw. Well, I'm happy now. Right. So, and I'm still here, which I don't think I would have been if I had stayed in some of the circles that I ran in early on in my early adulthood. I would not have survived it. I would have been one of those, died at 27, you know. If I was lucky, you know, someone would have remembered me, but probably not, because there were so many musical monsters on the planet at that time between, you know, well, just look at the few who died in there, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, who I didn't personally care for much, but he affected a lot of people. You know, that those are that's some high company there. I'm not. I don't think I would have been remembered at all, but I would have definitely gone down that road. You know, the road. You know, the wrong side of the road. I don't think I would have survived it because I wasn't centered. I didn't know who I was at the time. I didn't know what I was doing or what I wanted to do. I got this impression that that was the thing I wanted to be, but I didn't really understand what that entailed. And as I grew up with those people that were dying, I realized, you know, that it's my Jimi Hendrix story. I'll make it really brief. I got a glimpse of it at Earl Warren Showgrounds. A friend of mine used to MC all the shows there, so I often met the acts. And I walked into Jimi Hendrix's, like, green room, and the poor guy was almost dead, his face down on the table. It broke my heart, because I loved him. Who didn't love Jimi Hendrix? He was the god of guitar, then to me even more so than Eric Clapton or anybody else. You know, he was the guy. And I walked in, and I won't describe any more than to say that it broke my heart to see the condition that he was in. And the people around him, not one of them was in the room to help him, to watch him, to take his pulse, because he had an addiction problem. And what he also had was a people problem, because the people that surround you when you're famous just want to stay on the famous train, and they'll do anything they can to stay there with you, even if they have to keep you at death's door by getting you drugs that, you know, in heroic doses, right? And telling you, yes, 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 you want a woman, you want whatever you want, it's yours, you know? And it broke my heart, and it made me realize that rock stars have very little control over their own lives, and famous people have very little control, because the people that want to surround them are generally insecure and want to hang on to those coattails for their 15 minutes.
Well, rock
star
himself is, or movie star, is typically insecure too. That's what makes them great performers, is they're able to lay it all out there.
Right.
And then when they say, hey, you know, was I good? Was that all right? Oh, you were awesome. You were great. It doesn't sound genuine to them.
Right, it doesn't.
They realize that the entourage is like...
How are you supposed to know who your true friends are?
Right.
You know, that's a whole other world, and I feel sorry for really famous people. Yeah. Can't go anywhere, can't do anything. Everybody's watching. Praise. How are you supposed to learn?
It's empty praise for them, for just to stroke their egos rather than for to really build up what's inside of them. That is so beautiful. That and because, as you said, they're the paycheck for those folks.
Well,
and
sure. In the profession, because they become jaded, too. Like, okay, I did three comedy movies, and now I want to do a drama, and you walk into the casting manager, oh, you're the funny guy. I'm sorry.
They pigeonhole you.
You know? But I want to do drama. I want to do an action film. No, you're the funny guy. So you did these three movies. Now that's what you have to do for the rest of your career. So, you know, that comes with its own curse too. I remember Garth Brooks, awesome entertainer of the year. I don't know how many times. Great country artist, but he wanted to do these ballads. He wanted to do these acoustic stuff. And so he had to create an alter ego,
right?
Hair and go play in, you know, fish belly white, you know, bars under a different name in order to perform what he wanted to perform.
That's right. You know, that's why I stay home and record. Now, I worked in clubs for like 25 years. I don't need to go to another club. I do want to make my music. You know, so you have the choice. You can walk in the club and be the jukebox band and, you know, have people slobber on you and be drunk in front of you and tell you what to do. Play Big Bad John. Do you know Feelings? You know, or whatever, Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog, you know, all those songs that you never want to hear again as long as you live. Or maybe I should stay home. Maybe I'll put my money into toys that I can play with and do my own thing. And then it doesn't have to be for anyone else. It can be what I want to say and what I mean and the best that I can do. I can take my time, no pressure. And if somebody likes it, great. If they don't, who cares?
Right, you've expressed your spirit and your heart.
Yep, that's
without
it.
Without pressure from someone else to give
from a record company who's going to take your butt to the cleaners anyway. And this is just for anybody who thinks they want a major record label deal. I'd look that over real carefully because they give you all this money. Boy, they hook the musicians and the stars and the vocalists. Oh, we're going to give you $500,000 contract. You know, my music business manager turned down one offer from, I don't remember if it was Gene Autry or Warner Brothers. Somebody made an offer of like a ridiculously low amount, like $150,000 for me to make a couple of albums and, you know, all this stuff. And she said, absolutely not. And I, broke, driving around an old, you know, Dodge that shouldn't even be running anymore, I'm going, what? What do you mean it's not enough money? She said, let me explain this to you. They give you $150,000 up front, but number one, you owe them everything you think, do, and say for the 2 years of the contract. You write a song, it belongs to them. You record, they get most of that. They will charge you for every musician and secretary and cup of coffee and roll of tape at premium rates. Until all that money's gone, and the only way that you can even live is to go out on the road, which I wouldn't have handled well at all, because I don't like to fly. And you basically become a slave to the label. And I went, oh,
wow,
really? She says, you got to get at least, she said, an act today, and this was quite a while back, would need to get about $2 million up front to live the way they think they're going to get to live and to have some money left over and to pay off the record label for the producers and the studios and all that other stuff. So this thing with the internet where artists can now put their music out, whether anybody's going to like it or not, but they can do it almost instantly, that's changing everything.
Yep.
So it's not like Justin Bieber where your mom, you know, puts your music video on YouTube and the next day, you know, you're making $10 million a year.
Well, that happens for some few lucky people, I hope. But most of us, I think, are just lucky to get it out there and find a few dozen people who like it and go, cool, somebody liked it. They gave it a thumbs up. Nice. It would make me personally happier if they'd buy one of my albums. But I no longer attach money with the idea of happiness. Right. I was happy making the song. You know, and if I can still listen to it after spending a year creating it, it might not be too bad. So I'm happy that somebody else liked it too. That gives me a lot more joy than having to go to New York, which I love New York, but, you know, to having to get on a plane and show up at a certain time and be something for someone to fulfill their image of what they're going to get from me, you know. It's just, it's a little too demanding for me. I like to do what I do for me first now, and it took a long time to learn that. But I think the internet is changing the whole paradigm of how we communicate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I like the drumming circle.
Yeah. That is a good way to communicate. It is.
Do it for fun.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, you know, they say that, 7% of communication is verbal. Well, what's the other 93%? If you're on the internet, you're not even getting most of that.
It's non-lethal communication.
Well, yeah. People take pot shots, and they think that they can be. When I first went on AOL, because I'm a veteran of the flame wars of the early 90s online, and I was, you know, in my innocence, in my naivete, you know, saw the internet as a place where I could go find people, like-minded people, and be accepted and not be judged, right? So I went in, you know, AOL, some chat room or another about Wicca or whatever, Druidry, who knows what, you know, reincarnation, I don't know, something I was interested in, and I started talking to people. It was in 2 or 3 days I had several death threats.
What?
From people in that chat room or who came in later and saw my posts and, you know, wanted to send me to hell on fire because I wasn't wasn't acting like a born-again Christian. I love that stuff, you know.
I've been on the air for 7 years. I've never had a death threat. I've never even had a threat of harm.
Well, like I say, this was a long time ago, and it was when people were just starting to feel each other out on the internet in these chat rooms. But, you know, I saw it as an opening. Oh, boy, I can go in and communicate with these people. And then what I found out is if I wasn't saying what that particular group wanted to hear or some of those individuals, they could get darn nasty. And I don't take it too seriously anymore when someone puts a wisecrack on a video I made or something. I say, oh, okay, whatever. That's your opinion. You're welcome to have it. But people, it's the anonymity that they think they have because they're just typing to a screen. So they'll turn into a real smartass, right? They can be a smartass. This guy that always wanted to be the class clown and couldn't quite do it. So he comes into a place like Facebook or some other place and makes wisecracks and puts other people down. Because it's free, he thinks. He doesn't realize that everything he's putting out is going to come right back to him.
I'll tell you what I learned, and I learned from great friends like Mark, is after I had my event at James's.
Oh, yeah, that was spectacular, too, by the way. Just well, hearing about it was great.
The wrestling match from there was about ego. And Mark is the guy that helped me not only come to grips with that, but recognize it and keep it from building energy, and actually was responsible for X Squared Radio becoming what it is, because I figured it, everything that is put into the formula X Squared comes out positive except for one number. And that is an imaginary number called the square root of negative one. Obviously, if you take the square of the square root of negative one, you get negative one.
Which is negative.
Yeah.
Which is why it doesn't exist, yeah.
And that number is symbolized by the symbol I. So I leave I out of X Squared Radio, and it's about the guest. It's about the idea. It's about the news. It's about the function, and that's why it's not called the Brooks Agnew Show.
Don't you love the name of James's show and his story about As You Wish? That is just classic,
oh, yeah.
You know?
Yes, it is.
But thank you, Mark. If you,
but I was going to say, and the beauty, Brooks, is you haven't lost any love for the being that you are in releasing that. And it's just that you're not totally focused on it. And you're sharing it with everyone else.
Yeah.
And that is so beautiful, and I thank you for doing that for yourself.
Thank you, Mark, for helping Brooks, because I love his show and his work, and if you had any part in putting him out where I could find him, thank you so much.
All I can say is I spoke truth when it needed to be spoken, and he knew it was coming from the heart.